Welcome to the Ring of Fire Radio Podcast. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, we're going to discuss how the Trump administration has failed in its response to coronavirus, how the lack of oversight will enrich wealthy donors, and possibly Trump himself. Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project will be here to talk about all of it with us. We'll also talk to progressive candidate Samaliz Lopez, who's running for Congress in New York's 15th District. Her story is incredible. Her politics are amazing, and we will get her perspective on the idea of running for office in a time of COVID-19. And Nation contributor Ross Barkin will be here to explain why we just barely need to scratch the surface to see how New York Governor Andrew Cuomo helped get us in this mess. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. And it also gets you the full show. We're going to be putting some of it behind a paywall soon. So head over to ROFpodcast.com now so you don't miss any of it. Here to start the show off with the news of the week, Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, a lot of news this week. Obviously, some news in the Democratic primary. In some respects, it really is just sort of a formalization rather than something that is dramatically new. I think there was, you know, a sense that Sanders was looking for an opportune moment to end the campaign. He announced earlier this week, I guess it was on Wednesday, that he was suspending technically his campaign. He was going to remain on the ballot to essentially collect some delegates. At this point, he doesn't have the 25% needed to impact the platform or the rules committee of the convention. He did not issue a specific endorsement, much like Elizabeth Warren. He said Joe Biden's a good man and, you know, that he was going to work to help him defeat Donald Trump. And, you know, that's where it more or less stopped. And obviously, you know, a lot of disappointment. I was a supporter of Bernie Sanders. And I think he was obviously, you know, for a lot of progressives, he was obviously the last person in the race who was not Joe Biden. But, you know, I think one of the things that became clear during the course of the campaign was that about 65% of the people who were going into the polls, this is according to exit polls, which are, you know, are only so accurate, but I think 65% is a pretty big enough number that you get a sense of that's what was going on, said they were voting based upon who they thought could win, not based upon whether they subscribed to that person's policy plans or ideas. And you know, I think there was a time where it looked like it could go either way in terms of whether Sanders was that person who could win or Biden or anybody else for that matter. But really the thing that sealed the deal was, I think, the sort of cascade of endorsements that Biden got. And I think, you know, frankly, the Democratic electorate was, you know, basically saying like, you know, I don't know who can win. Have somebody tell us who can win. And then a bunch of people told them. And so that's what they decided. And that's what happened. I don't know. What are your thoughts at this point?
Well, I think you're right about that. I think that's probably, I think the idea of who could beat Trump was always really the only real issue that was driving the electorate. I mean, obviously on the progressive side, There's a strong agenda there, right? That exists through in every campaign. It existed in 2016. It existed in 2004. It existed when Obama was running, and people sort of thought at the time that he was sort of carrying that banner. And so, in primaries, and that's what primaries are for. You know, people vote that way for the most progressive. I mean, I think that's the way it should be. You vote for the most progressive. This time, I do think there was just this overarching concern about whether or not that, you know, who could beat Donald Trump. And I think that you're probably right, that people were looking for signals on what that was and the signals that came out, and from other people, too. I mean, I think the African-American community's support of Biden throughout in polling and then finally in the actual vote count, that mattered. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was just about it had nothing to do with a rejection or particularly a rejection of Sanders' agenda or an acceptance of Joe Biden's, which really isn't an agenda. What Biden was saying, you know, the country's gone off the rails and I'm a normal person. That's it. You know, there really wasn't much more than that. I will, you know, Trump has destroyed the, you know, the dignity and the, you know, whatever, you know, American pride there might be, and I'll bring that back. And it was a very, very simple message. And, you know, it's compelling on a certain level, I think, to a lot of people. But that's it. So it really didn't have, I don't think it had much to do with the rejection of Bernie's policies, which, in fact, most polling showed that you know, majority of the party supports. And what's going to be interesting about this, if Biden does win, and it is really a referendum on Trump, I mean, I don't care who was going to be the nominee, it was always going to be a referendum on Trump. It usually is in these situations, and particularly so this time. What will happen is the dynamic as if Biden wins will be completely different than it was with Obama. When Obama came in, there was this tremendous sort of, you know, support that existed on through all factions of the party at the time, and the left among them. I mean, I argued for months with people over Obama's grand bargain and was told, you know, trust Obama. He knows he's got this. You know, remember all those memes? You know, he's got it. He's going to, you know, you don't have to question him. He knows what he's doing. That will not exist this time. I mean, Joe Biden has a completely different dynamic. And I think that as a result, the progressives, because of what's happened here, and largely because of Bernie's sort of energized movement that will be out there pushing for those policies, you know, I think Biden's going to have a much different sort of landscape to try and put everything, you know, to try and do anything, much less try and pick up the pieces from Trump and then advance a progressive agenda. So I think that we're going to be looking at that battle will continue, I think, very strenuously if Biden wins. And I think the progressives have much more strength and much more, you know, ambition now to try and use their clout within the party to actually get some of these progressive, you know, agenda items enacted. And we'll see how that works, you know. I mean,
and in many respects, let me just add to what you're saying. It's on both sides of the coin on some level. Obama, like you say, came in with a tremendous amount of support. And also, you'll recall, I mean, I know that you and I spoke about this a million times. In fact, I think the interview that he gave when he talked about entitlement reform is seared in my mind because of how many times you would tell me about it. You know, and I'm talking, this is, you know, 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
More. And but Obama, you'll recall, over the summer of 2008, when he became the nominee, he basically said no money to outside groups. He starved any of these outside groups, and
right.
He essentially, you know, jettisoned Obama for America, which turned into, you know, Organizing for America, but really it didn't go anywhere, and none of that dynamic exists in this instance. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are enthusiastic Joe Biden supporters, but I've never met one. And, you know, I'm not a social person, so that could be part of it. But the Biden campaign is certainly not in a position to sort of consolidate power. It is also the outside groups are of a different profile. There are
right.
some legitimate powerhouse or gaining power outside groups that have really no that are founded on the idea of being in tension with the Democratic Party,
right.
as opposed to the sort of the old veal pen that we would talk about
right.
back in the aughts. And so the dynamic is very, very different. I mean, I think you and I are going to have a lot of time to talk about that going
yeah.
forward. But one thing I do want to talk about is this notion of the election being a referendum on on Trump. Because the interesting dynamic here was that many people argued that if you nominated Sanders, it would not become a referendum on Trump. It would become less of a referendum because all of a sudden it would be, do you want a socialist? I don't know if I buy that, but that was sort of the the talking point. And certainly what Trump is going to try and do with Biden is going to be, you know, do you want this guy who's like neck is, you know, knee deep in Burisma? And it's going to be right. another sort of Benghazi thing. I think everything that's happened in just the past 4 weeks, really, has completely changed my calculus as to how dangerous that is. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like the 4 or 5 weeks ago, we were not dealing with the potential of a depression or a recession or even greater depression. We were not dealing with a crisis that the president completely botched. I mean, botched is not even the right word for it. Was willfully negligent. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I honestly think that in another context, you could charge this guy with manslaughter. And so it does feel like at this point, it is simply going to be a referendum on Trump and Joe Biden. He's the guy to make it a referendum of Trump because he seems to be nearly invisible on some level. Mm-hmm. And the question is just like, you know, can he make it across the finish line? I mean, am I being overly, I don't know, worrisome in articulating that?
Well, I think everybody's worried about that. I mean, I think, you know, there was worried, I think, on both the Biden and the Bernie side of, you know, septuagenarian candidates, you know, are they going to make it across the finish line? And there's always, this is going to be underlying everything going forward. And even Trump is no spring chicken. I mean, what, he's going to be 74 at the beginning of his next term? I mean, that's not exactly young. Anybody who's, you know, sort of in the super coronavirus high risk group probably is, you know, a little over, you know, over the line for being a viable presidential candidate. But it is what it is. And I do think that everybody's worried about that. But you're right that the entire dynamic has shifted because of the coronavirus, you know, the pandemic crisis and Trump's handling of it. And Biden, in my view, I think probably is doing the right thing by just, you know, by kind of keeping this sort of low level, you know, presence in the whole thing, because the minute he gets in and starts, you know, and I'm not even sure how he would do it. I mean, you know, he does interviews and they're fine. You know, he doesn't sound terrible in them. He has good ideas. He, you know, has a whole, you know, plan and process for how he would deal with it if he were the president. But, you know, who cares, right? No, but I don't think everybody said, well, that's nice, but you're not the president, so just, you know, shut up. And he, talking about campaign stuff doesn't really work. And he, you know, the Democrats and the never Trumpers who are actually pushing the hardest on Trump's botching or, you know, his negligence in this thing, that's out there. And what's happening, I think, in the polling, and this is really important because Ron Brownstein, who I've mentioned many times on here, I think he's maybe the best political analyst out there. He has said that, you know, what you're seeing in the polling, and it really it's kind of a foreshadowing of where we may be hopefully in November, is that no matter what happens now, I mean, it's all a tragedy. There's, you know, all these deaths, all this sickness, the economy is going to be in a depression. What will matter is not whether or not we're starting to come out of it or the stock market's up or whatever. It will be what Trump did in the beginning. And that is starting to solidify in the polling, it looks like, in this latest round of polling kind of confirms this, that people understand that he botched it, that he wasn't paying attention. You know, and of course, you know, if you look at his entire presidency, over time, you begin to see how he reacts, right? He's defensive about everything. He only brags and blames. He's not someone that would look at some kind of a challenge like this and embrace it and say, okay, let's get in there and get this thing done. I mean, that's just not who he is. So it fits with his previous reactions to everything. And that is starting to sort of be in there. So as a commonly held idea that people understand that he did not do the right thing. And by the way, the more he comes out and does his rallies in the White House there, in the coronavirus rallies every day, I think the more that sort of confirms that feeling, because the guy clearly is not really particularly conversant with how to be a president in a time like this. So, I think that Biden, I don't know if he, I worry every day that the guy's, what is he, 78? Right. I mean, come on. I mean, this is ridiculous. But getting him over the finish line, getting to January, I mean, this is crazy. But that's I think, that all people are hoping for. Get Trump out, get him in January, and of course the VP choice is going to be extremely important.
Yeah, I want to have that conversation, because I think that conversation's heating up, actually. But it seems to me what's happening in terms of the polling is not that there's any new information that people are getting in terms of Trump's performance in the beginning, but what's starting to happen is, and I say this with some trepidation, it appears that New York has peaked and mm-hmm. is starting to stabilize. Certainly in California, Gavin Newsom was sending ventilators east. Mm-hmm. There are certain areas on the coasts where, the more dense areas of the country, the ones that are sort of like tend to be more international in some ways, they have stabilized. They have seen the worst of it. And now it's moving to places like Florida and Texas into rural areas. And I think what's happening is, for a couple of weeks, people in those areas were like, he must have done a good job because there's no problem here. I mean, we may be staying inside or we're being told to be careful. Fine. But it's all working. I don't see any problem here. And I think what's happening now is they're turning on the local news and they're starting to hear about problems in their local hospitals and in their local communities, and they're starting to hear about deaths in their neighborhoods, and they're starting to wonder, like, wait a second, I thought this was taken care of. So I don't know that they're necessarily reassessing the work that Trump did. They're now reassessing the results of it. And
yeah, I think you're right.
And I think that's going to get worse. And I mean, what is coming clear to me is that, and I think this is, everybody who's been reading about this knows that those first 2 weeks are the most important 2 weeks of the entire thing, right? Like, this is something you need to get out ahead of. And if you're not getting criticized for being overly cautious when you first make a move, then you're probably doing it wrong.
Right.
Based upon how this thing spreads. And I'm of the mind that we're going to be in this for a while. And one of the things that I think maybe we should just touch on this week, we're starting to hear phase four stimulus rumbles. And we should remind everybody that what happened in Wisconsin this week was a travesty. They held this election. The Republicans essentially forced it to happen. Not only did the Republican legislature in Wisconsin force it to happen, the state Supreme Court also forced it to happen when Evers basically pulled the plug and said, no, we're just not doing it. I'm making an executive action. My health inspector basically says, no, not happening. The state Supreme Court forced it to happen. And then the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, and incidentally, that week-long extra that you had to count absentee ballots that came in late because a lot of people signed up to get the absentee ballots late, and apparently you could sign up 3 weeks ago, and they still hadn't sent it to you. There's video of people saying that out in front of the polling places. The Supreme Court said no, the ballots have to get in by the 7th, and they didn't even bother reverse the fact that they had another week to count them. I mean, that's what was sort of like incredibly egregious about the whole thing. Like, wait a second. Why can't they come in late if you're deeming it okay to count, until this right. coming Monday? And this is my roundabout way of saying, like, now that we, you know, now that the mask is off in terms of what the Republicans are willing to do, both from a statutory standpoint, both from a state court standpoint, and both from a federal, from the federal Supreme Court, it seems to me it's incumbent upon Democrats. And now I'm talking about Pelosi and Schumer. And it's one thing to say, you know, Joe Biden, he's going to step back. He's going to deliver right. on that promise of like, you'll never think about the president. You know, I mean, like he's sort of doing that form and function type of thing. Like, here's a taste of what my administration's about. You'll never hear from me. And that has a lot of allure to people. But somebody in the Democratic Party has to be doing something. Somebody has to function like an opposition party. And the idea I'm starting to see, you know, some reports of what Schumer and Pelosi are asking for. And I, you know, who knows? But the idea that they would not include two basic things, one being like a methodology to vote that does not require people to physically go out to the polls, like a mail by ballot or something to that effect. And two, a automatic stabilizers. So it's not like here's a one off. And if we need it, we'll come back for more. No, there should be benchmarks. If right. we still have 10 million people out of work, you know, come November or, you know, come January 21st, 2020. Then there's another round of stimulus, because we know the Republicans will not play ball if a Democrat wins and we still have this problem. Right. They're going to do what they did last time. And, right. and it seems unconscionable to me that Schumer and Pelosi feel like they have ownership of this and therefore they shouldn't really try and get anything that's going to be helpful that could sink the bill. I mean, this is Donald Trump's. He owns it.
Well, I agree with you completely. And, you know, the Wisconsin situation, I mean, we had a vivid illustration of the problem here in every way. I mean, they were willing for people to die in order to go out and exercise the franchise. I mean, this is like, you know, asking people in the Deep South after, you know, during Reconstruction, you know, black people to come out and risk being, you know, lynched or something. I mean, this is an egregious, horrifying example of the lengths to which they will go to suppress the vote. And this is true nationally. They'll do it wherever they can. They have done up to now, but this one was just so vivid. You're looking at that iconic picture now that says, this is ridiculous, of people standing 6 feet apart from each other, standing in line with masks on in the middle of an epidemic and being forced to do that in order to exercise the franchise. And a bunch of them did it. And that's, you know, kind of it's an amazing testament to people's desire and willingness to vote. But how many others just said, you know, I can't, I can't take my, I've got kids, I've got a life, I can't do it. And that's exactly what the Republicans wanted. And the fact that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, looked at that absentee thing, and in the entire opinion that they put out, they didn't mention the pandemic. It was as if it wasn't happening. It was this weird abstract thing where they're all, you know, well, you know, the law states that you have to do this, that, and the other. And it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, they sure stepped out of that lane in 2000 when they gave the vote to, you know, when they gave the election to George W. Bush. But this time they couldn't do that. They couldn't step right. out of their normal little abstract academic, you know, viewpoint and actually do something in the emergency to allow those people to vote for their absentee ballots to be postmarked after the date. I mean, that's all they were asking for.
And so, they still allowed the voting to continue until following Monday. That was the amazing thing about this. That's why we don't know who won. That's it. And I just want to be clear about something. And I haven't heard much of it, and I'm glad to not hear much of it. But some people I've heard say something to the effect of like, why would Bernie Sanders stay in that race? It caused all these people to come out. No. The Wisconsin primary, you and I look at it as the Wisconsin primary, but for Wisconsinites, there was a state Supreme Court justice, which is really why the Republicans wanted to do this. And then dozens upon dozens of like mayoral races. There was a lot of general election non-primary stuff happening in Wisconsin. And I think if you were to talk to some like Wisconsin politicos in the Democratic Party, they would be thankful that Sanders stayed in that they had some type of chance to get that state Supreme Court back, because, or at the very least to keep it from going. I think it would be like 5-2 or something to that effect. I mean,
Well, and there's an issue out there of the voting in November based upon this Supreme Court makeup. This guy had recused himself, the one who was on the ballot, and he isn't going to unrecuse himself concerning the disenfranchisement of, they say, a couple of 100,000 people for the November election. What was on that ballot on Tuesday was the November election in Wisconsin, which, as we know, is pivotal for whether or not the Democrats can win. This is why the Republicans, which is, you know, the Republican Party in Wisconsin is owned by the Koch brothers. I mean, we've known that for years. Scott Walker was a Koch brother creature. And so this whole thing was really about voting rights. I mean, that entire election, I mean, everybody knew that the primary was irrelevant. It was about that race. It was about the state Supreme Court. It was about this right-wing justice. And Donald Trump even admitted it, that it was about that. He has it wrong. He says it was about whether or not he endorsed him, because everything's about him. But he brought it up in his coronavirus rally that, you know, that's what the election was about this Supreme Court. And what you saw was the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin and the U.S. Supreme Court making a blatantly partisan decision. There's just no doubt about it. So what we're looking at, and getting back to your original point, is that we're looking at a November election that it is absolutely, they are going to use the pandemic, they're going to use the economic, you know, crisis that we will undoubtedly still be in the fall, to justify suppressing the vote, cheating on a level we've never seen before. I mean, I'm just going to be blatant about it. This is cheating. They're going to try and rig the vote for Donald Trump, because, you know, that's probably the only way they can really assure that they're going to win. And the Democrats in the Congress, and I'm not privy to what they're doing, what their strategy is with all this, but all I can say is
anybody
observing it. No, I don't think anybody is, but as an outsider observing it from afar, I'm willing here, you know, if they're putting up any kind of, you know, trial balloons here, the one I want to see is something like Elizabeth Warren's plan that she came out with this week to, you know, on expanding voting rights that should be a part of this particular legislation, which is just, there has to be a vote by mail provision across the country. And there has to be for November and beyond. I mean, this is, we've gotten to the point now. I mean, Sam, how long have we been talking about this? And you can go all the way back, of course, to, you know, again, to Reconstruction, to look at vote suppression in this country. But the modern Republican conservative movement, whatever that is, and now has morphed into just sheer Trumpism, this has been at the basis of their political project, has been to deny the vote to minorities, to deny the vote to college students, to ensure that, because they know that if it's just left up to the people, they have a minority of the American people, and so they cheat. And this has gotten to a crisis point now. I mean, in 2000, they took the election in Florida. Ever since then, places like Ohio, you remember in 2004, that whole thing, the fact that they are constantly crying voter fraud when it doesn't exist. Their own people are the ones who are fraudulently using the mail-in ballot issue, as they did in North Carolina. The only people who've ever been indicted for that were Republicans. And now we're at a point where, I mean, this is becoming very blatant. It's becoming obvious. And the Democrats just have to find a way. And, you know, I'm not going to second guess what the best way to do it is. But we're at a moment right now where, you know, Donald Trump, his back's against the wall. This economy is crumbling, and the only thing that can, he can try and open up the country, but he can't make people go to restaurants. He can't make people go out and go back to work. He can't do that. Whether he likes it or not, we're in a situation where this country, until this virus is perceived to be, much less actually is, you know, has been beaten back to the point where some semblance of normal life can come back. It's not going to happen. You can't do it. You can't make people go out. You know, I mean, sure, there'll be a few who'll go out and, you know, put themselves at risk. But for the most part, he's got to do that primary job of dealing with the coronavirus. And so in the interim, until that happens, the government has to step in with massive economic aid across the board to states, to localities, to individuals, to businesses, to everything, because, you know, this is unique. And if they do have leverage here. I don't think he is in any position, and neither are the Republicans, especially as you point out, people are going to start dying in rural red states. And are they going to be in a position to then say, hey, sorry, guys, no more money. Here you go. Go back to work. I mean, I think that the Democrats have to push this, and the election in November is going to
depend upon it.
Do you think they will?
I mean, I don't know. Because on some level, like I was willing to sort of cut some slack on phase three, right? I mean, it was quick. You're sort of, you know, we've never really experienced
something this
dramatic, and something needs to be done. But, you know, we've had a week or two now where theoretically everybody should have gotten their bearing and said, okay, here's a strategy going forward. Here's what we want. Here's what we think that we, you know, here's the latitude that we think we have. And I just have not seen them come out with anything that appears to reflect that kind of strategy. Do you know what I mean? Their approach does not seem to be one that reflects a strategy. And it is.
I see the strategy on the Republican side. Mitch McConnell wants to split up all these phase four initiatives, you know, one for the small business, one for this, one for this, so that he can take it, so that he can remove the leverage that the Democrats have.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And
they can't let him do it. I mean, do, then we're sunk.
On Thursday, anyways, they basically stopped the first SBA expansion. But who knows if they have a stomach for this,
it's always about that, isn't it, Sam, with the Democrats?
Always.
That you have. And it's a problem. Look, I am sympathetic to them, because when there are people suffering, you know, your instinct is to say, look, we got it. You know, we've got to help them. But that was the thing about the phase three. They got 4 months, I think, of this unemployment insurance extension, right, which was $600 extra a week.
Yep.
They bought themselves time on the individual suffering basis to, you know, really push hard on this, on the next phase. They did get that done, if they have the stomach for it. It's not easy, because there will be suffering involved. But they have some room to maneuver, I think. And in fact, when they did that, when I'm going, wow, $600 a week for 4 months, and of course the economy is going to be, you know, garbage up until then, at least that long. That was a smart move. I'm going, wow, that was pretty good. Now, are we seeing any evidence that they're going to use that as, you know, they're going to hang tough here and push it hard so that Trump is, you know, looking like the obstructor? I don't know. But, you know, they, in my view, they need to try, and I guess we'll see what happens. But, you know, I can see what the Republicans are doing. No, and they're not being opaque about their approach. So, you know, let's just say we don't have a lot to go on with these guys. Democrats rarely are willing in these kind of do-or-die situations to push it to the limit. And sometimes they really need to do that. And,
right.
You know,
it's absolutely
one of those times.
It's terrifying. And, you know, you had mentioned, and that's why, you know, I think the voting is so crucial. And because, you know, you had mentioned. Yeah, it really is. And you know, the voting is one of those things where, you know, even if you are super cynical about how folks like Pelosi and Schumer perceive, let's say, you know, Wall Street versus everybody else. And I am certainly open to believing that, you know, they fundamentally are oriented towards finance and corporations, you know, not like the Republicans are, but beyond certainly where I am. I am open to that. But the voting thing is just, you know, pure. This is pure power for them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you are really in the bag for corporations, at the very least, do it properly and get the power so that you can do their business, right? Like, I mean, the voting thing is the one thing that McConnell's will definitely never address. They do not care. In fact, Donald Trump said, like, they want to get this voting stuff in and it's all special interest, you know, whatever. I mean, it's yes, voters being able to vote. That's basically what we're talking about. To protect that is really just, it just seems to me to be, you know, that is just a sheer assessment of like, of power and competence.
Sure, of course, yeah.
And, but let's talk about, since we're talking about that, one more thing about Bill Barr this week. You know, we had many instances of the Trump administration's incompetence, memos going back to January, reports from intelligence agencies back in November saying, hey, this could be a real problem. I mean, just completely ignoring it. This story, I've talked about it quite a bit on the Majority Report of the U.S. government sourcing personal protection equipment overseas and then bringing it back here and giving it to private or selling it at cost to private distribution companies. And they went ahead and basically started auctions and sold some of it back to Europe because they were just going to the highest bidder. Never mind, you know, like the market did not do this efficiently. It cannot do this efficiently when you allow them to price gouge. And then stories of like a Republican fundraiser, a professional fundraiser who 3 or 4 weeks ago wrote a letter to everybody like, I quit. I'm out of the business. I'm now in the personal protection equipment business, and is bragging in a Politico piece that he has the possible largest supply chain of N95 masks in the world. And people are like, well, how did you get that? And he's, relationships. Like, you know, what relationship does he have as a Republican fundraiser? I mean, this is, and I'm talking to Jeff Hauser in this show about the failure of the Democrats to do any like meaningful oversight or to talk about it at any point. But then we have Bill Barr crawling out of his rock this week to, of course, opine upon hydroxychloroquine. Queen or whatever it is that is the, you know, the favorite drug by the Trump administration that Greg Abbott in Texas apparently decided took it upon himself to administer it to a nursing home, an entire nursing home without permission from any of the family. This happens on the day after the French stop using it because it's causing cardiac arrest. He comes out, he talks about that, but then he says something else. Tell us about what else Bill Barr was basically, his new project, as it were.
Well, we remember that he had, you know, after the Russia investigation, you know, the Mueller probe and then the impeachment, Barr had been working feverishly on doing what was called the Durham investigation, where he had the special prosecutor in Connecticut. It is a criminal investigation, by the way, which means that he has the authority to do all kinds of subpoenaing and potentially indictment of people. Barr pretty much came out on Laura Ingraham this week. He went to Laura Ingraham's show and said a bunch of stupid stuff, like about the hydroxychloroquine thing, and then said that he believed that this was the greatest travesty in American history, the Russia investigation. And this is before the report comes out. So, I'm pretty sure that they are cooking up, dropping this report, perhaps with some indictments, at the most opportune time they think for them politically, whether that's in June, which had been, sort of projected earlier, or earlier than that, or maybe later around the time of the convention. It's hard to know. But they're going to use this as a way to, you know, gin up their enthusiasm among their base for electoral purposes. I mean, there's really no doubt about it. And meanwhile, you know, they're doing their Bill Barr is out there, you know, sending out proposals to curb habeas corpus and to curb all kinds of normal due process during the pandemic. And, you know, they had a weird press conference a week or so ago where they brought out, they're doing some major new drug interdictions. So what you're seeing is, you know, both a political play on the part of the Department of Justice under Bill Barr to help Donald Trump get reelected, and also a tremendous power grab that is, you know, potentially really, really dangerous. I mean, what you're seeing is, I mean, if they were able to, they presented this report about due process and habeas corpus and all that as a proposal to Congress, which won't pass it, obviously. You know, Nancy Pelosi will draw the line at that. But nonetheless, this is out there. I mean, and I think that what you're seeing is the sort of outlines of what we could expect if Donald Trump had a second term, on where the Department of Justice is going to go, and it's really strikingly extremist. And, you know, I think Bill Barr will do everything he can to help Donald Trump get elected using the levers of the Department of Justice to do it. And, you know, at the same time, Trump's firing all the inspectors general. He fired another one this week, fired the intelligence community inspector general, and he is continuing with the purge. It just goes on and on and on, just getting rid of anybody that he perceives to be disloyal to him. So they're in a position to use the levers of government in terms of the intelligence community and the Department of Justice to help Donald Trump get elected. And, of course, this is all in an atmosphere of an unprecedented emergency. You can just imagine. I don't know if anybody's keeping their eye on the ball on this. I mean, the reports are out there. We're getting them. Bill Barr was on Laura Ingraham bragging about it.
Yep.
But who's paying attention, right? I mean, you know, it's like there's only so much bandwidth. So, you know, I mean, I've been writing about it. You're talking about it. We're trying to continue to keep our eye on that ball. But, again, Congress, as you say, They're missing, completely missing an action on this. I mean, even the firing of the inspectors general, they had Chuck Grassley, who's been a big whistleblower proponent over the years, came out and said, you know, well, this is really bad. You know, we need to know more. You know, my response, you know, on Twitter was like, you know, from Donald Trump says, yeah, what are you going to do about it? Impeach me? Because
right.
I don't think there's any limit at this point. I mean, they are done. The election is all we've got. And again, here we go. We're watching the corruption of the election on a level that could be more extreme than anything we've ever seen. So, you know, that's a very, very scary prospect in this atmosphere of catastrophe that we're undergoing and massive deaths and all of us sitting at home and the entire economy shut down. I mean, I hate to sound alarmist, but this is not business as usual. And there are people in the administration. Donald Trump is an ignorant twit. Who, you know, could botch his own reelection if left to his own devices. Bill Barr isn't, and neither are a whole bunch of other people that are working behind the scenes to use the government in ways that could assure his reelection, you know, in a corrupt fashion. So, you know, we need to keep our eyes open to what's going on there.
Yep. A lot of things to keep track of. As always, Digby, always a pleasure. We will reconnect next week.
Okay. Thanks, Sam. Take it
easy. Now, there's no doubt the Trump administration has screwed up in the response to the coronavirus pandemic. But our next guest has laid out how House Democrats have failed in their response to President Trump's failure. Here to discuss, Jeff Hauser. He's the executive director of the Revolving Door Project. So, Jeff, there is a lot going on that I think requires a lot of scrutiny, both in terms of the anemic, maybe that's even too complimentary, response by the Trump administration to this sort of freight train that was barreling towards us in the form of a global pandemic. And then there is another element to the response that appears at first glance to be a tremendous amount of sort of monetizing the response by friends and acquaintances and perhaps the president himself. Let's go. Well, let's just start with this. Give me a grade as to how the Democrats have been doing with their promise back in 2018 when they got elected and took control of the House. How are they doing in terms of oversight?
I think, to be generous, it's like a D minus. And if it wasn't for Maxine Waters and her committee, we might be in the F range. They have made a very conscious decision that oversight will be perceived as political. And as a result, they have made a political decision to not do oversight. And the irony seems to be lost on them that making a decision to not appear political is, in fact, the quintessential political move. And politicians are always going to be believed by voters to be political because it's kind of in the title. They're politicians. So they have been scrupulous in avoiding the perception of oversight. It took the incredible violent assault on Joe and Hunter Biden by the Trump administration to muster any serious oversight. And, of course, that like very narrowly drawn impeachment, while entirely warranted, was not the type of measure that was going to generate widespread bipartisan condemnation. And the conclusion that they drew from that is that oversight is bad politics, and they kind of said as such after Trump's acquittal in the Senate. And as a result, Trump has been ever more emboldened. And the problem is that that is bad enough in normal times, and with amidst a pandemic and amidst the dispensation of trillions of dollars of money, it's a particularly bad time to have a president who feels that he is over oversight.
I mean, we're talking on a day where in the past week he's fired unilaterally two different inspector generals when we talk about oversight. And I would say, like, you know, and before we go sort of from the marker you've just set down, are they really reacting to impeachment when they say that oversight is not is not politically a net positive? I mean, let's put aside the sort of like, well, you got a job to do. And maybe right. The idea is you do your job and you figure out how to sell it politically rather than letting your interpretation of politics determine what your job is. But putting that aside for a moment, I mean, I look back and I think Richie Neal, who is the head of the Ways and Means Committee, he could have had access to Donald Trump's taxes 2 years ago, and he still hasn't. There's a IRS whistleblower out there somewhere. I don't know. It seems to have disappeared.
Good point.
And all of these decisions were made before impeachment, were they not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, their baseline assumption is that oversight was bad, and then they've only doubled down on that since impeachment failed. I think that it is true that if you ask voters leading questions about oversight, you can probably get them that voters would rather everybody get in a room and solve the nation's health care crisis. And even honestly, majorities would like to see the climate crisis solved and any number of other issues addressed on a bipartisan basis. But, you know, many children want ponies. That doesn't mean they're going to get them. And realistically speaking, we're not going to see a bipartisan consensus emerge to fix health care in this country that involves Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, and Nancy Pelosi. But what the Congress can do is try to make sure that the executive branch is working. And as we've all become much more familiar with the Center for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health in the past few weeks, we should just be reminded that we probably didn't think about those agencies much in the prior years. And the basic point is that the government is pretty big for really important reasons. Like, there's a part of the government that is supposed to prevent pandemics. It's really important. In fact, when it functions most effectively, we don't think about it because it prevents problems. People had stopped thinking about Ebola because the government under Obama had been competent enough to keep Ebola as a problem essentially on Africa, and a problem that was solved for a period of years in Africa. So we don't think about government, but the only way to have a government that we don't need to think about is if Congress is providing oversight of it and making sure that it's effective. And that is particularly necessary when you have a president as corrupt and incompetent as Trump and a team of people around Trump like Jared Kushner and Steven Mnuchin, who are entirely untrustworthy individuals. So, yeah, they really needed to be doing oversight. And they, I think it turns out to be good politics on the regular. I mean, there was nothing to the Benghazi investigation, except we only know about Hillary Clinton's emails because of the Benghazi investigation. So it's just so ironic that we had a not corrupt administration in Obama in which the Republicans constantly pursued oversight and reaped political rewards. And now you have a completely corrupt administration and the Democrats won't do basic oversight of it. And in fact, they're saying explicitly, Majority Whip James Clyburn has said that they're only going to be looking prospectively with oversight. They're not going to look back on how we got into this mess. And
yeah,
I don't know about you, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, I want to get deeper into Clyburn's, what he's been saying and how comprehensive his comments should be taken by people like us who are concerned with oversight. But I want to break this down a little bit because we have a history of Donald Trump and the Trump administration, frankly, Republicans, right? I mean, John Bolton, who is an avowed enemy of Donald Trump now, was also had a hand in doing things like firing and essentially ending the position of the top coordinator of pandemic response in the country that sat on the National Security Council. The version of him that existed at the Department of Homeland Security also cut. We know from reporting that that the pandemic researcher for the CDC in China was cut. We know that the entire team of the CDC that was embedded in China to observe these things and to comment on them and to help them and to warn us was cut over the past 2 years. I mean, there's reasons. You have oversight that is necessary for, you know, making sure that people understand who's responsible for what. There's oversight for to make sure that people don't get the sense like, hey, there's no cops. I might as well just take this TV.
Right.
And there's oversight for just like, hey, good government. You know, we were a victim of our own success insofar as like Ebola or we were a victim of our lack of suffering with something like SARS or MERS. And we need to have a plan for the next president who comes in to say that, like, hey, job number one should be to reconstitute the pandemic response team that sat on the National Security Council. And if we don't have oversight and there's no report generated, there's just a couple of disparate articles in The Washington Post, we're screwed, it seems to me.
Absolutely. You do. There can be positive political byproducts from oversight, but that should not be the purpose of it. And that's historically not been the primary purpose of it. It is, in fact, to have better governance. It's to have better governance in real time because there are cops on the beat. And it's also to learn from the acts of oversight to figure out what needs to be done in the future. And so we at Revolving Door Project should have a piece out later this week where we argue that part of the reason why the Phase 3 bill is inadequate is that because of the absence of stringent oversight of entities like the Treasury Department and the Small Business Administrator, we don't know that Congress didn't fully understand the lack of capacity at these places to help serve America's small businesses. And so the bill, which to some extent was admirable in intentions with respect to small business, is going to prove to be a failure. And that failure would have been understood and could have been addressed in advance if there had been more serious oversight of the executive branch. And this also goes to the ability of a potential Biden administration to make realistic plans for the future. We need Congress to begin to figure out what's going on in these different agencies and departments of the executive branch, to figure out how much expertise has been rotted out, how many scientists have fled an anti-science administration, and what we need to do to replace them and expand expertise of the federal government. We need to start learning that now so that a potential new administration can hit the ground running and so that additional legislation addressing the pandemic can be written against the backdrop of actually understanding what is the federal government capable of doing, what capacity needs to be built by legislation. We just need more facts and more understanding to write good laws or for a potential Biden administration to make coherent plans. And right now, they're not doing the spade work necessary to produce good results in the future.
Well, all right. So let's start with this then, because I want to get to what needs to be happening. I want to get, I want to get fairly specific with it. But what is happening now? Clyburn came out and he said that they're going to, I guess, say like, oh, we're going to be a cop on the beat going forward. Is that right? Now, clarify for me what your understanding is of Clyburn's committee and which committee is that? The Government Oversight Committee, I guess. What their jurisdiction is, as you know it, in terms of their mission, and what's going to be involved in it? I mean, it just seemed, and is his going to be the only commission that is like sort of involved in this oversight? Or is he just saying like my specific commission is just going to be moving forward? There'll be others that are, looking back.
So there are normally pre coronavirus, there are 26 committees that the House of Representatives is involved in. Six of them are select committees on various issues, including intelligence, which is what was the key committee on the Ukrainian-related impeachment. 19 of them are specific standing committees. So those are the ones in charge of particular areas. So there's an agriculture committee, and they look over the Department of Agriculture. And there's the Ways and Means Committee, which you alluded to earlier with Chairman Richie Neal, that is in charge of taxes and Medicare and the like. So there are 19 of those committees that have subject matter jurisdiction that's written into the rules of the House of Representatives. And then there's a 20th standing committee called the Oversight Committee, which can look across everything. The new committee that Pelosi and Clyburn have announced has not actually yet been voted on. It would have to be added to the House rules, which the majority can do whatever they want. That's not exactly a heavy lift, but it's not actually happened because one of the big problems with the way Pelosi is running the House is that she's not implemented any sort of remote voting procedures. So the House of Representatives right now is kind of like Wisconsin in terms of to vote, we're going to have to vote in person and risk a lot of people's lives. So that seems to me not right. So there's a lack.
Do you think? Let me ask you
this,
Jeff. Do you think that is by design?
I sadly do. I hate to be this skeptical, and I don't think it's the most skeptical in terms of. The way you might see it, the most angry people on Twitter asserting this is about corporate interests or what have you. I do think that deal-making between leaders and a reliance on unanimous consent in the House of Representatives is a mechanism that strengthens the leadership of the House, and it's essentially a whipping mechanism to prevent progressive revolt in her ranks. I definitely think that the House not having robust procedures in place to operate remotely, which includes formal committee hearings. There are some differences in committee rules, so I hesitate to speak completely universally, but for the most part, committee hearings are not occurring at all. And that's insane. That doesn't mean committee work is not happening at all. There are paid staff who are working as hard as they can from their homes. Work is happening, but there are not formal committee hearings, even as so much of the rest of white-collar America has adjusted to Zoom and other teleconferencing
right.
services. And this is, I think it just, it allows all power to inherit to the Speaker of the House, and the House of Representatives is no longer an unruly institution. It is really an edifice entirely controlled by Pelosi, and so I think she thinks she is a more prudent guide than the unruliness of her broader coalition, and so I think preventing remote voting serves her interests, which I don't think are malevolent. I disagree with a lot of them. I'm not imputing anything malevolent to her. I think she's a patriot, but she's a patriot who's accumulating power. And so
she's accumulating power, and she also feels quite strongly that the way to succeed is to just simply, you know, four corners this, it seems to me, which is a reference, you know, to college basketball. And we're just going to kill time because Donald Trump is, you know, messing this up in many respects. And they just think that if we get involved in this, we risk, you know, changing the subject from his failures. But that to me seems ridiculous. I mean, I can understand having those concerns, but there could be a way to approach those concerns and to continue to do oversight and set yourself up to deal with these things, right? I mean, that's my take on this, is that there's just sort of like a lack of boldness, a lack of confidence, and, you know, it's like, to stretch the sports metaphor, when you play not to lose, very often you lose.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on your prevent defense and four corners references. In fact, it's kind of like going to the four corners after the NCAA finally instituted a shot clock. It's an antiquated approach that makes more sense in a 1990s media escape than today.
Yes.
It forgets how quickly tides can turn and that, you know, a lot of American voters have the memory of, you know, insert your metaphor there, but like, they do not have long memories. And but there's a preference for passive approaches, this notion of avoiding mistakes rather than actually just taking initiative. And I just feel more comfortable in politics trying to take the initiative, and I just don't see that being Pelosi's approach. If you believe political science models that you can input economic data and output political results, then Biden is guaranteed to win in a landslide in 2020. If you think American politics is more complicated than a mathematical model.
So isn't Hillary Clinton, by the way, in 2016.
These models are deeply imperfect, but they tend to give an exaggerated sense of certainty, which actually, it's ironic because Nate Silver himself, his writing is very clear about the uncertainties of his models. But I feel like Pelosi is only getting half of the information out from this consensus that, like, well, it's obvious that Trump has screwed this up, which true, but that as a result, Democrats are going to benefit. And I just think, you know, it's 7 months until the election. There are lots of shenanigans that can happen with respect to the election, as we are witnessing tragically in Wisconsin today. And I just don't have that degree of confidence. And I'd rather try to use the powers of the House of Representatives on behalf of the American people rather than just hoping all things kind of proceed to a victory without doing very much in the next 7 months.
I guess I am just slightly more cynical because I think it's both a temerity and an overconfidence about, you know, all we need to do is just watch him hang himself. But I also do think that there's this element of control, and that control is not just for the sake of control, but it's a concern that things are going to spin in different directions and that there may be political movements that come out of these things that might be harder to control. Like, for instance, if Nancy Pelosi thought that the oversight of contracting was a broad socialization of things, or if there was a sense of like, well, all these people have lost health insurance, and the answer is actually more Obamacare, let's say, or I think if there was a guarantee that that would be the outcome, I think there would be less concern. I think there's also sort of like when we talk about control, it's a control and the concern that there might be political outcomes that we don't like from this. And so, all right, let me ask you this. Three committees, if you, Jeff, and I am willing, to the extent that, I mean, I have no vote within the Democratic caucus of the House, but if I'm in a position to get one and to nominate someone as the Speaker of the House, I'm going to nominate you. And I'm going to do so based upon the three things that you would do, the top three things that you would do in terms of oversight going forward. What are they, Jeff? You're almost guaranteed locked to get my vote, but it's not that valuable.
I would empower the House Financial Services Committee, which does have the one really aggressive and excellent chair in Maxine Waters. But I would give her all of the staffing resources. And by the way, they've not actually voted the House the additional resources that are needed to provide oversight to the radically expanded executive branch, which is a huge mistake. But I would give her team the resources necessary to really have a permanent oversight of the Trump stimulus, because so much of it is going to get run through the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, which are within their jurisdiction. And we really need to follow the money, and we really need to empower whistleblowers in those departments to feel comfortable that an entity, the House Financial Services Committee, which is not going anywhere, is going to have my back if I come forward and tell my tale of corruption and incompetence. Because I think those stories are there to be told. They need to be told. We need to learn what is and is not working, and we need those cops on the beat. The Energy and Commerce Committee has power over healthcare. And as you alluded to, I think when you have the federal government basically paying for such a large chunk of all economic activity in the country, this is kind of the opportunity to do things like socializing chunks of medicine that are otherwise the political economy is almost impossible. But there are a lot of entities which only are going concerns because they're going to be fed tons of money by the federal government. And you could use that to neuter the political economy forces, which otherwise stand in the place of getting health insurance to all Americans. You'd like to see an Energy and Commerce Committee monitor the response to coronavirus, monitor the implications for other health care, because obviously it's a terrible time to be a cancer patient or even like to have a busted up knee or something in New York City or across the country. We really need aggressive figuring out what went wrong and why our for-profit system, which costs, you know, nearly 20% of the overall gross domestic product of the country, doesn't have enough ICU beds in case of a pandemic, which Steven Soderbergh knew was coming 10 years ago, but the healthcare industry in this country seems not to have been prepared for. Third and foremost, I would want to empower the Oversight Committee. Elijah Cummings was a tragic loss, and I think the fact that we don't really have a serious figure doing oversight. Carolyn Maloney is a nice enough member of Congress, but she's no Elijah Cummings. She's no Henry Waxman. We need a House Oversight Committee that inspires fear, that can take over the nation's media ecosystem and draw attention to issues. There are going to be problems across the entire government. The House Oversight Committee has the ability to go in and out of every aspect of the federal government and basically the entire economy and root out corruption. It's a huge, almost impossible mandate. You need larger-than-life figures who are willing to take risks and go where the truth leads them. And I've not felt the House Oversight Committee's imprimatur the last 18 months or so.
Jeff Hauser, founder and director of the Revolving Door Project. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
Jeff Hauser is a lawyer and the director of the Revolving Door Project, which focuses on exposing political corruption. Our next guest is running to replace Congressman Julian Serrano in New York's 15th District, who announced he'd be retiring due to his battle with Parkinson's disease. Here to discuss what it's like to run for office during a pandemic and why she's the right person for New York's 15th District, Samalise Lopez. So, Samalise, you are running for Congress in the 15th Congressional District. This is essentially the northern New York City, Bronx, primarily. And so, first off, give us a sense of, like, you know, what is that district? What can you tell us about the folks who live there, and how democratic it is? What the socioeconomic breakdown is?
Right. So I'm running in the 15th congressional district of the South Bronx, and the district is 97% people of color. It's a working class community. It's the most democratic county in the entire country, but it's also the one that's most heavily dominated by machine-style politics. So in terms of the issues that we're experiencing, we're known as the poorest congressional district in the country. So we have a lot of economic challenges. We have high rates of homelessness. We have an opioid crisis in the community. So, anything that you can imagine, you know, the South Bronx has it. But one of the things that I say consistently on the campaign trail, even though we have very dire set of economic challenges, we shouldn't just define ourselves as the poorest congressional district in the country, because out of that struggle, you know, we came out resilient. We came out a very beautiful community. We have been shaped by the history of the Young Lords and the Black Panthers here in the community back in the 70s and the 80s. So even though we've gone through a lot with the burning of the buildings that the landlords themselves in the 70s and 80s did to their own housing stock for the insurance money, you know, we've come a long way since then. So, you know, we're resilient and stronger than ever. So I'm really proud of this community and the prospect to represent it. And in terms of my platform, I'm fighting for a universal home guarantee, universal health care, universal child care, environmental justice as well, because this community has faced a lot of environmental racism over the past decades with bad economic policy choices that our political leadership has engaged in. It has brought in bad actors that have polluted our airs and basically taken over the lungs of our children. So we're fighting for a Green New Deal. And one of the most important things that our campaign is standing against is the influence of big money in politics. So I'm not taking any corporate money, any real estate developer money, or pharmaceutical money to finance my campaign, because we want to basically speak to the values and the needs of the community. So as it relates to me, I have personally experienced a lot of the issues that my community has experienced. I grew up in the homeless shelter system with my family. My mom was a domestic violence survivor, and that's why we ended up in that situation to begin with. And our experiences as a family are not unique. My mother also worked in sweatshops to make ends meet and as a seamstress when she came to this country from Puerto Rico. So, you know, our experiences are not unique. And certainly the experience of the congressional district that I hope to represent are not unique either, because many people in the country are experiencing similar things, especially right. With this pandemic taking hold of the coronavirus.
I want to touch on some of those issues that I see on your website right. at lopezforthepeople.com, but also the reports. Well, I want to talk to you about how one campaigns, in this environment, and also the reports that low-income folks, people of color, are suffering more during this pandemic, at least in this country. And I want to get to that in a moment. But before we do, just tell us, I mean, you've told us a little bit about yourself. You also have had, in terms of your upbringing in the district and... but you've also had a lot of experience, it seems to me, for someone who is as young as you are, in all sorts of politics and public service. You have a master's in urban planning. Tell us about your experience and how it prepares you for Congress.
Oh, absolutely. First, I would say that my lived experience is definitely something that, prepares me, because the policies that we've undertaken and the platform that we've undertaken in the campaign, it's basically giving respect to directly impacted people, because I'm a strong believer that directly impacted need to shape policy, and it cannot come from an ivory tower, and it cannot be imposed from the top down. You know, policy and organizing really has to take shape from the bottom up. and the most directly impacted that are experiencing these issues on the day-to-day absolutely need to have a seat at the table. So in my view, political representation should be about that, being intentional about creating that space for the movement to have a seat at the table, to create those laws that will benefit everyone's lives. So I would say my lived experience with oppression, witnessing oppression, you know, basically guided me in the path of community organizing. And that taught me from a very early age that we need to stand up for the underdog. We need to fight against injustice. And all the things that I ever, you know, experienced led me on the path to community organizing, public service, giving back. I went on to Barnard College after I went to junior high school in the district. Then after college, I interned for Congressmember Jose Serrano, actually. And I learned a lot from him in terms of the environmental justice movement, because he did a lot in terms of seeking guidance from the movements based on the ground and local activists to restore the Bronx River. So, you know, I take a lot of my cues from my lived experience, professional experience. I was there with him for a little bit, and I moved on to work for his son when he was elected for city council. And I directed constituent services for a number of years. And I would help out with constituent housing casework and other kinds of issues that came through the office. And then what I would see when I would help out those people at the office to cure things like one-shot deals at the welfare office to prevent them from being evicted, which are essentially one-shot grants when people are facing eviction, the same people 6 months, 7 months down the road come back to the office with the same issues. So then I was like, okay, it's a great experience working here, but I don't feel like I'm making a dent in terms of being a part of the creative process of building housing, to prevent people from coming into this situation that I once was in when I was growing up. So I decided to get a master's in urban planning so I can learn about affordable housing development and affordable housing finance, to essentially learn how to put deals together and learn about financing to build housing from the ground up. So after I graduated there, I spent the next 3 years of my professional life in the affordable housing industry, working for not-for-profit developers in New York City that were building housing for people in vulnerable situations and people coming out of the shelter system. So I decided to choose the affordable housing industry because everything that I personally experienced in my life. And, you know, I was a part of, you know, a wonderful not-for-profit affordable housing space where we, you know, built thousands of units for people, you know, to live in dignified homes. And then on the side, I also did a lot of political organizing, community organizing. I became enamored with Bernie Sanders when he came on the scene nationally in 2016. You know, as a young person at that time, I was taken by his message, and I still am taken by his message of social justice, the importance of building progressive movements and multiracial working class coalitions, that we can fight for the change that we want to see in our society, and so that we can embrace transformative politics. So I co-founded an organization called Bronx Progressives that came out of the Bernie Sanders 2016 election, where we educated people about local politics and got them to run for positions like county committee and democratize political information so that directly impacted people and activists on the ground can take over the local Democratic Party and transform it. Because I feel that because it's so machine dominated, the politics here, sometimes this information, it's a little mysterious to get to. And if people want to run for certain party positions, like you don't know where to go. So we formed a collective to basically demystify the local political process and say, these are your respective party positions, and anybody that wants to run for these positions should run, and you don't have to ask the blessing of your local party boss to do so, because that's not the democratic way.
And that's,
so a lot of organizing around that. And, you know, then obviously AOC, you know, came on the scene. I met her during the Bernie Sanders 2016 election in the South Bronx. And, you know, we spoke and, you know, we met. Then when I found out that she was running for office, I invited her to come to Bronx Progressive meetings. And then as a group, we ended up endorsing her because she's a powerful woman of color who was not only talking the talk, but walking the walk. And we did this before she won her primary in 2018 at a time where nobody in the city wanted to support a candidacy like hers because everybody was with the safe, comfortable establishment choice.
Right.
So
and
we
that's,
decided
and
to
when you talk about the machine
and support her.
When you talk about the machine, she was going up against a part of that machine. I mean, literally, Crowley.
Oh, yeah, a very big part of the machine, right.
Chairman of the Democratic Party, I think it was in Queens as well. And so so give me a sense. So having done that, you have a tremendous amount of both lived and academic and, you know, professional experience in all in and around the issues that you're running on and issues of social justice. And in a district that desperately needs representation to get these type of resources and to get these type of plans going. Who, give us a sense of who you're running against, because, you know, obviously, if, you know, if Joe Crowley could do a do-over, he would. A lot of those people would. I imagine you're running up against a sort of a similar type of establishment, mm-hmm. but you know, the surprise attack is not going to happen as in the same way this time around, that they now realize that this could happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the lay of the land is it's a very crowded primary. So I'm running for Congress along with a bunch of corporate Democrats. And a Democrat who is actually a Republican in Democratic clothing, who's known for homophobic statements and is not for women's choice, women's reproductive choices. So that's kind of like the field that I'm, you know, up against right now. So all of those candidates have histories taking real estate money, corporate PAC money, pharmaceutical money. You know, some of them have taken money from contractors that steal wages from workers. So in our campaign, we have definitely set ourselves apart because we've rejected that kind of funding. Because when you fundraise in a certain way, that's actually what shows to the community where you stand on the issue. So, you know, we've taken that stance because I come from a working class background. I come from a very humble background. And I want to continue to honor those roots in my community and take those values to Washington. So, you know, overwhelmingly in the door knocking that we were doing before the coronavirus epidemic took hold, that's one of the big issues that people in the district care about. They care about removing big money out of politics. Because right now, this congressional district is experiencing a gentrification and a displacement crisis at all levels. So we cannot afford to send real estate, you know, Board of New York candidates to Washington. We have to send working class champions that will put the needs of the community first unapologetically. And an important way to do that, a critical way to do that, is taking, you know, rejecting this kind of money from taking a hold over our democracy and our values and our needs in the community. So that's definitely something that sets me apart from everybody who's running in this field right now. And also, like, historically, I've been against rezoning. I've been against jail building. I've been basically on the side of the community the whole time while they use their platforms to, you know, for other means, right? You know, that haven't necessarily been uplifting for the community. So I take a community organizing approach to everything that I do. And I center the values and the needs of the community. And I see political representation as a way of holding myself accountable to the movement on the ground. Because like Bernie Sanders says, change never happens from the top down. It always happens from the bottom up. And I'm a believer in that. That's what we saw in the civil rights movement. That's what, you know, we saw in the organizing that happened against Amazon in Queens. Organizing always happens from the bottom up. So I think that the responsibility of elected officials is to hear what's happening on the ground and create a space so that the movement politics and the movement activism that we see on the ground that are really the ones doing the work of change, so that that vision can be translated into electoral power. So I think that's, you know, the vision, you know, that I have, that I've been fighting for, and the rest of the members of the squad and Bernie Sanders himself. And I'm really sad to see that he's not continuing his race. I mean, I was ready to bat for him until the very end because I believe in him 110%. And what he did for me in terms of like educating me about politics, I mean, I've never met him personally, but what I know of him, I mean, he did a great service to me and I'll never forget him. And I'll root for his policies, you know, to the end. So that's kind of like, you know, what we have. We need to move away from a transactional, broken political system and embrace the politics of transformation.
And so let me ask you this, and let's turn to this era of coronavirus, COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there is more and more information that is coming out, more and more data that is showing, I think pretty conclusively now, that the infection rates, that the mortality rates amongst people of color, particularly African-Americans, but across the board, it seems, people living in low-income areas is significantly higher than than wealthier people, than white people. And I mean, I, you know, the reasons seem to be, I think, fairly clear. It's two. It seems to me, and you tell me if there's something else that you notice. It seems to me there's two steps to this. One is that folks living in low income areas don't have the resources to work at home. They don't have a job maybe that they can work at home. They work low pay service jobs. They get forced to go in. They don't have the resources to say like, hey, wait a second, I can't go in. I'm not, you know, this isn't safe for me. They also don't have the resources, to isolate themselves as they go in. They can't take, you know, they're taking public transport.
This is completely right.
And then on the other side, you have underfunded hospitals in their neighborhoods. So the mortality rate is even going to be even higher relative to the standard mortality rate because they either are underinsured or not insured, and the medical services are just not there for them. So
maybe you should be running for Congress, Sam.
Well, no, I mean, look, the data is there. It's pretty clear. And it's horrific. And obviously, I think, you know, we have a situation where, you know, this is a folks who are marginalized, folks who are low income are essentially the canaries in the coal mine. And, you know, to extend the metaphor, you know, there's deadly gas in the coal mine and they are the first people who are going to feel it and feel it the worst. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, with that knowing, and I imagine that drives what you're doing and it makes it makes even more sense of your campaign to people. But how do you get that message out when your campaign is not based upon raising big money, which means that you don't have the corporate donors who are saying like, we're going to put you all over television. We're going to put you all over the internet right now. How do you, when you have a campaign that is really designed in many respects to actually have, you know, contact with other people to organize, how do you deal with this situation?
Yeah, no, everything that you listed is completely accurate. And I want to plug in the South Bronx as a whole. Like I said earlier in the conversation, it's 97% people of color. A lot of frontline workers, a lot of delivery workers, a lot of people that don't have access to healthcare. We have a lot of people that work in the healthcare industry in the South Bronx that are also putting their lives on the front lines. So there's a lot of need. So if there's any moment in history that we need to continue to fight for universal healthcare as a human right that is not tied to a job, it is this moment right here, because this is what this pandemic is showing, that we need to embrace other ways of being, other paradigms that help us look at the world differently. Because clearly the corporate capitalistic system that we have right now is not serving the community and the interests of the working class. And we have to continuously remind ourselves that we need to fight for a people's bailout. And we need to recognize that it's the frontline workers and that it's the workers in this country that create the wealth in this country. So we really need to, you know, have a paradigm shift that, you know, takes us from, you know, point A to point B so that we can have our values align. And specifically in the Democratic Party, we need to reclaim the soul of the Democratic Party, which is our working class roots. And right now the party is being overtaken by corporate interests and lobbyists that have no regard for, you know, the well-being of Americans. And right now what we're seeing is a lot of disaster capitalism, you know, in this coronavirus response from the federal government all the way down. And in New York State right now, we're seeing the governor. I don't know if you heard the news, but he has cut Medicaid at a time where, you know, we're facing a coronavirus, you know, pandemic. So that's kind of like what we're dealing with here in the community. New York City right now is at the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. So we need to honor the people, the frontline workers and workers in this country and like in our community specifically that keep our communities afloat. Because right now you have the elites that have their vacation homes upstate and in other places of the country, and that's where they're at because they want to protect themselves. But like working people don't have that choice. Yeah. Working people still have to take the train. Working people still have to put like bread and butter on the table for their families. So they're risking their lives, sometimes even knowing that they may have symptoms because, you know, they can't afford not to go a week without a paycheck. So we need a people's bailout. And I'm proud to be endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America, as well as AOC and her Courage to Change PAC. And we're all aligned in that way. And those are the values that we're pushing for, because the vast majority of Americans are making $30,000, $40,000 a year. So, you know, in light of that, on March 19th, we released a set of coronavirus demands that you should check up on our website whenever you get a chance.
That's Lopez for the people, I should say.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I should say that's LopezForThePeople.com.
See, yes. And so you should take a look at that. So on March 19th, we released a set of demands that center the South Bronx in this conversation around coronavirus. For all the issues that you and I have been talking about, the South Bronx has been disinvested in for decades. We've, again, faced a lot of environmental racism. We have one of the highest rates of asthma and respiratory illnesses in the country as a result. So already our community, because of this disinvestment and the redlining that we've experienced for decades, have put us in a very dire position, you know, confronting COVID-19. So it's time to, you know, demand like a different set of priorities to take root in the community that embodies the mutual aid principles of the Young Lords and the Black Panthers from back in the day. Because while the government gets its act together, we really have to rely on ourselves to be there for each other collectively so that we can survive at this time.
So what our campaign has been doing,
we shifted from door-to-door organizing, and now we are doing all of our organizing digitally. So that means Facebook ads. That means, you know, reaching out to people with phone banking to check up on our neighbors and the people that we've already engaged in the door knocking phase to just say, hey, you know, we're here. Like, it was great to meet you at the door a few weeks ago, a few months ago. We're checking in on you to see if you need anything, if you need food assistance, if you need, like errands or anything like that to be run if you're homebound. So we're using our campaign right now as a public service to check up on our constituents to make sure that they're okay. And we're also reminding them about the election and about Governor Cuomo's new executive order that was really a push from the activist community to provide, you know, mail-in voting and absentee voting for everybody in New York State in light of what's going on with the coronavirus.
Well,
so
I got to tell you,
we've shifted entirely to the digital organizing space, and you know, we're looking to do virtual town halls, and you know, keep checking up on our neighbors through phone banking and text banking.
Sam Elise, I got to say, you know, when I went to your website, like I said, was LopezForThePeople.com, and I saw that one of your links, or basically your menu items is a mutual aid sign up. I was really impressed. It is great to see you using your campaign in that way. And folks obviously can head over there and get in touch with you, help by donating and by providing some of that mutual aid. Sam Elise Lopez, the website is LopezForThePeople.com. Running for Congress in New York's 15th district. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, Okay, muchas gracias, Sam, and I look forward to meeting up with you in the Bronx if you ever decide to come up here and visit. You have a home here.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Sam Lees Lopez is running for Congress in New York's 15th District. You can find out more about her campaign over at lopezforthepeople.com. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been getting positive reviews from people across the country because of his press conferences in this age of COVID-19. But his history is less than stellar. In fact, his actions just in the past a couple of weeks don't add up if he is so concerned about people's health care. Here to tell us how Cuomo helped get New York into this mess, Ross Barkin, contributor to The Nation magazine. So, Ross, Andrew Cuomo has certainly attracted a lot of attention in largely because of his press conferences and, I guess, to some degree, also the response to what's happening in New York, and it has been happening in New York in terms of the COVID-19 situation and the lack of facilities, the lack of equipment for to deal with this crisis. But we should say that I guess there are, you know, a lot of there's a lot of concern amongst, frankly, amongst progressives that this moment in time is not really representative of who Andrew Cuomo is. Just give us a little bit of a backstory, because the situation that we're in today is obviously, you know, Andrew Cuomo has nothing to do with COVID-19, but in terms of our preparedness for this, he does have some of his actions that he's taken in the past definitely have implicated the ability of New York State to respond.
Yes. So Andrew Cuomo, for those who are enamored with him, and I'm speaking particularly to people on the left, those who would self-identify as progressives, you know, the issue with Andrew Cuomo is that as governor over the course of almost a decade now in New York State, he is not governed as a progressive. He has accomplishments like raising the minimum wage, getting marriage equality passed, and more recently some more progressive bills. But you know, for a long time, just talking politically, he kept the Republicans in control of the state Senate. He was very involved in ensuring a deep blue state like New York had a divided legislature. And then in terms of this crisis, he has been trying to cut Medicaid funding, and he was successful in the budget that just passed. Some of the cuts are going to be delayed so New York can get matching funds from the federal government. But Andrew Cuomo, someone who's not supported keeping hospitals open, he's presided over a decade of closures and over two decades, and this goes back to before Andrew Cuomo was governor, New York State has lost about 20,000 hospital beds. So he certainly isn't someone who has fought to keep hospitals open. There's a hospital in Brooklyn that actually Mayor Bill de Blasio hoped to keep open. This was really the centerpiece of his campaign, and Cuomo allowed it to close shortly after de Blasio took office. So, you know, he's someone who's really governed the state with an austerity mindset. He hasn't always been successful. That's the key. The state does spend a lot of money. Medicaid spending is still quite high in New York, but whenever he's gotten the chance, he's really tried to reduce spending, reduce certain services, and this is now the second time he has attempted to cut Medicaid reimbursements, and he's been very determined to do this even in the midst of a horrible pandemic. When you cut Medicaid, simply you're also cutting funding to hospitals, particularly public hospitals that are very reliant on this and are very poorly funded, relatively speaking, and run deficits. So Cuomo's cuts to hospitals are going to be really painful down the road, and this is something that some lawmakers in New York have raised alarm about already.
All right. Well, let's go back and let's take break these things down. And we should say, just, you know, broadly speaking, when we're talking about cuts, there are options, right? One of them is to raise revenue. He has played around with property taxes as a way of giving tax breaks to very wealthy individuals. He has also been instrumental in preventing legalized marijuana in New York State. And the estimates on what that could bring in terms of tax dollars is extraordinary. But let's go back a little bit. You said that Andrew Cuomo has been, in many respects, governing since day one as an austerity minded, you know, I think in many respects, like one of these old, moderate Republicans who is looking to defund the state in many respects. Well, just walk us through the IDC. I mean, when we say that this guy basically allowed control to Republicans to control the Senate, I mean, this was a plan that he orchestrated to make sure that in one of the bluest states in the country, he would not get legislation that would be to the left of where he was, so that he could hide the fact that he was stopping it, essentially, right? Just tell us how he did that.
Yes. So this is going to be in the weeds a little bit, but it's actually quite fascinating because for a long time, until the year 2019, New York State had a divided legislature. So New York itself is a Democratic state. The last time you voted for a Republican was Ronald Reagan in 1984. So that gives you an idea of where voters are. But for a long time, we've had a Republican state Senate due to gerrymandering, due to geographical disparities and sort of a traditional power in the suburbs and upstate. And this status quo was in the process of dying out. It was not sustainable in New York, given the registration numbers, to have a Republican state Senate long term. In 2008, Democrats took control. They did lose it in 2010 in the Tea Party year, and then Cuomo became governor shortly after that. So he did enter office with a Republican state Senate. The real crux of the story, this is where the sin comes in, and this is where I believe progressives and Democrats and those fawning over Andrew Cuomo really have to pay attention. The Democrats won control of the state Senate in 2012. That was the year, of course, Barack Obama won re-election. Turnout was high. Democrats were riding very high. And it was clear the era of Republican governance in New York was over. It just was not sustainable. It didn't make sense, just given the voter turnout, given who's voting. So Cuomo, instead of accepting that, allowed, sanctioned, and really encouraged behind the scenes this independent Democratic conference, a small group of breakaway Democrats. They'd formed their own third conference in 2011. They hovered there. You know, they had some interpersonal issues with the regular Dems. And he allowed them to form a coalition government with the state Senate Republicans. And it was this coalition government, which is unprecedented in New York State history, that froze the Democrats out of the state Senate. So basically what you had was a minority Republican faction with this IDC, and they co-governed the state together. And what this meant effectively was that progressive bills like strengthening laws to help tenants stay in their homes, to help renters in particular, criminal justice reforms, bills like the DREAM Act, which gave tuition assistance to undocumented immigrants, all these progressive measures were roadblocked in the state Senate. And the genius of this, if I'm going too in the weeds, you can stop me. The genius of this was that, as you said, if a progressive bill got blocked in the state legislature, Cuomo could throw up his hands and say, well, it's the Republicans in the state Senate. What can I do? I'm just the governor. They've got to send the bills to me. So it allowed him to play both sides. It allowed him to, on one hand, have this sort of centrist view of government really put into full effect, but it also allowed him to placate critics by offering this not really plausible explanation that he had nothing to do with it. And one other thing I just want to add very quickly, Cuomo also helped Republicans take control of the state Senate because he allowed them to gerrymander their own district lines in 2012. That's very important too. The governor signs off on those lines. He initially said he wanted independent redistricting in New York. It was not independent. The Republican majority leader gerrymandered the state Senate. Hence, we had almost a decade of Republican rule after that point.
Yeah, I mean, it really is astonishing. And it was, you know, it's sort of like the crisscross, right? I mean, this legislation gets killed and nobody, and I don't have my any blood on my hands is what Cuomo was doing. And then he also, we should say in that first term, there was people who know, and I look, I think, you know, largely, unless you really, really were in touch with what was going on in local politics, state politics in New York State, I don't even think a lot of the people who were represented by those IDC people knew what that meant. They saw the word, you know, independent, Democrat. Oh, great. That sounds good. I like independent people. I like Democrats. And they didn't really fully understand what was going on. We had a situation with Cuomo where there was rampant corruption in Albany. And part of his campaign was to set up the Moreland Commission, which was a commission to look at it. And then when they got too close to corruption that was around him, he shut it down. Just to give folks a sense. I mean, this is just like a chapter of New York political history that people seem to forget. And so he orchestrated the death of all this progressive legislation, not unlike, frankly, Mitch McConnell, except for he got away without having to take responsibility for it. And then you had a challenge to him in 2014, I think it was, from Zephyr Teachout, yeah. Basically calling to attention some of these things, particularly in that race, if I remember correctly. Cuomo's big push after Ken Langone, the owner of the billionaire owner of Home Depot, sat him down and said charters are the way to go. He had this big push to privatize education in the state. Zephyr Teachout called a lot of attention to that. And then we are brought up into like the year that we see people like the rise of AOC. And frankly, you had Cynthia Nixon. What we can attribute to in terms of progressive moves from Andrew Cuomo is a function of him being afraid of Governor Nixon more than anything else. And she really drew a lot of attention to this IDC, and all those IDC people got voted out. So Andrew Cuomo has been stuck in this situation where he has not been able to count on the Republicans from quashing this progressive legislation and this progressive governance. And so now he's been in a bit of a jam, and he uses, in many respects, if you ask my opinion, because he's been trying to cut this Medicaid for a long time, he is using the cover of what is going on now with COVID-19 to push through that austerity budget where he cuts Medicaid. And again, we could have had a lot of billions of dollars worth of tax revenue with legalized pot in this state. You got people driving over to Massachusetts. You know, there's more New York license plates in Western Massachusetts trying to get pot there than anything else. It's ridiculous. And go through what the implications are of these cuts to Medicaid, because one of the problems that we have in this country is that, you know, we have 14 million people unemployed probably as of today. Maybe it's a little more, maybe it's a little bit less. We're going to have more. And we don't know how we're going to give health insurance to the vast majority of these people.
So the worst implication of the Medicaid cuts is the loss of funding to hospitals, particularly the public hospitals. Now, New York has a relatively low rate of people who are uninsured. We do a pretty good job of covering people, and that's in part why Medicaid spending has increased despite, you know, Cuomo's fighting to cut it. But the real tragedy is going to be when these public hospitals that are fighting coronavirus every day lose funding. These are hospitals that treat poor patients. So these aren't patients who come in with health insurance. They don't come in with those private plans with the big reimbursements. They come in with nothing, or they come in with Medicaid. So you've got this situation where the pain is really yet to come. These hospitals right now are in the fire. They are day in and day out in Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx fighting to keep people alive. And These cuts, though they've been somewhat delayed due to the fact that federal matching funds for Medicaid wouldn't come to New York State if Cuomo kept his austerity plan in place. That's the irony of this. These cuts are still expected to come. So the great implication is the pain that will be caused in the hospital sector, particularly public hospitals. And I would add that you made a point before, which is very true. When you've got a shortfall, why not raise revenue? And I've been shouting about this for a while now. It's amazing that New York State is going to be billions of dollars in the hole because of coronavirus. We know that. And a normal governor, even someone who's not terribly progressive, would talk about raising taxes. You have to. You have to get revenue from somewhere, whether it's from marijuana, which Cuomo claims to support but has never really fought for, or from raising taxes on the wealthy. And New York still has a large number of millionaires and billionaires, or doing things creative like bringing back the stock transfer tax, taxing luxury homes. There's a lot you can do. And the amazing thing is Cuomo rammed this budget through, and there were no tax increases at all. And I made this point too before, that even Michael Bloomberg, the plutocrat of plutocrats, raised property taxes in New York City after September 11th, because even he understood that you need to get money from somewhere. And when you have a crisis that blows up your budget, you don't want to just eviscerate your services. And my personal fear as a New Yorker is Cuomo is going to use this crisis to drive a severe austerity budget down the throats of New Yorkers. And I would add, it isn't just this budget. Cuomo has the power now, in part because the legislature and their complicity in this, to make rolling cuts to the budget throughout the year. So what seems like school aid right now, public school aid, I believe, was held flat. That can be cut, you know, in a few months from now. There are periods where he can just take a scalpel and just slice up all of these services. So that's a real fear. And for me, at least, as someone who studied the 1970s fiscal crisis in New York City, I worry that we are heading down that path where services are going to be severely reduced and you're going to have social unrest. And I hope we can avert that.
Lastly, Ross, why do you think he's doing this? I mean, look, it's a very blue state. If he believed this stuff ideologically, he wouldn't have used the IDC as a fig leaf to achieve these goals. If he felt that's what the people in New York wanted, I mean, is it and yes, I suppose it could just be that this guy is so in league with the millionaires and billionaires in this state that he doesn't want to tax them just because he is of that ilk. But I imagine that there's more to it.
I as someone who's covered Cuomo now for almost since the beginning of his tenure, it's hard to say. At his core, Cuomo is a corporatist and a capitalist, and he is someone who will do progressive things, but he'll only do them if he's dragged there. He won't raise the minimum wage unless you build a campaign for years and years, and he reluctantly does it when he decides it's good politics. So his politics fundamentally aren't of the left. He comes from the Clintonian third way mindset, that this is something I've just come to believe watching him. And now he really has the cover to do a lot of this stuff. And that's really the fear that progressives should have. And this is something that people should be a lot more aware of, because his poll numbers have gone way up due to COVID-19. He now is going to be able to pursue the kind of budget he's always wanted to pursue, which really are those bare bones budgets. You know, like I said, you look at Cuomo's record as governor, there are real progressive accomplishments, but these usually come despite what he really wanted to do. They come from public pressure, from labor unions, from the Democratic State Senate, which finally took office in 2019 and really pushed a lot of this stuff through. So now you have this situation where we are in a wartime crisis, and there is very little scrutiny of what Andrew Cuomo is doing, and he has the cover of high poll numbers where a lot of legislators are afraid of him. They were always afraid of him, but when Andrew Cuomo had an approval rating of 40% or lower, which is what he was running for a long time, you could buck him. Now he's at 70%+, and he's a national media darling. So he's got really a lot of political capital to do a lot of damage. And this is something that I hope voters, Democrats, progressives, those who pay attention really wake up to in these next few months.
Ross Barkin, writing in The Nation, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Ross Barkin is a contributor to The Nation magazine and columnist for The Guardian. His latest piece for The Nation is Cuomo helped get New York into this mess. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. Special thank you to all our free podcast subscribers that converted into members last week to help support the show. We, of course, are not on radio anymore. You are our only source of revenue. We can't thank you enough. And if you are listening to the free one-hour podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at ROFpodcast.com. We haven't put anything behind a paywall yet, but we're going to soon. So don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And you can check out my daily show. I'm doing it from a bunker now. It's called The Majority Report. We're live every day at noon for about 2.5 hours. We do long-form interviews. We do news coverage every day. Of course, it's available later as a podcast, and you can also check out our news brief that we've done in the morning now. It's about 6-7 minutes of your top headlines, AM Quickie. You can find it at amquickie.com or, of course, all over wherever your podcasts are served. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.